We love bringing you the Rufus Project each fortnight, and we really hope that you enjoy listening to it. But you know what? You can help us keep this podcast free and, I suppose, increase its profile. How can you do this? Well, first up, the easiest way is to just share us on social media. Share the podcast, talk about perhaps one of the sections that you liked, tell people about the competitions. If we're having a movie competition that is a movie that they like, that would be fantastic. You can also leave us a review on iTunes, or just give us some feedback on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Podomatic, Ustream. The list is almost endless. If you do happen to have a little bit of spare cash laying around, well, you can also head to our homepage, therufusproject.podomatic.com, and hit that donate button. We would be very, very appreciative, and we're hoping to set up some sort of reward system in the not-too-distant future. Maybe you want something a bit more substantial. Guess what? We have a Spreadshirt store where you can buy men's, ladies' and kids' t-shirts with a huge range of one design at the moment based around our very public domain mascot that you might see on the little podcast picture. It would make a great talking point and again would certainly help us promote the podcast. Just head to the Rufus Project .spreadshirt.com.au to browse our fine selection of one design. Finally, if you have a product or service that you think may be of interest to the Rufus Project listeners, then please contact us at rufusreviews@gmail.com. Anyway, that's enough of this stuff. Let's get on with the podcast. Welcome to the Rufus Project, your fortnightly guide to geek news, game, movie, cult movie, whatever we think is appropriate slash fun to talk about at the time. I'm your host, Trevor Holland, and a little bit later on, you will also be hearing from my good friend, co-host, and king of retro cinema in Brisbane, Christian Fletcher. But what do we have in store for you this podcast? Well, after the geek news, we're going to have a look at SBS On Demand. Christian is going to revisit a classic movie for its 30th anniversary, and I'm going to have a look at the new Maze Runner movie. We're then going to see if we can redeem what is probably considered one of the cheesiest movies of the 80s, before we have the triumphant return of an actual interview in our local wildlife section. We talk to one of the amazing people behind the incredible upcoming Music in the Moonlight. If you get a chance to go to this, seriously, do it. It sounds phenomenal. Christian, of course, will give you a rundown of some of the upcoming events around Brisbane, and we have two great competitions where you can win double passes to see some classic movies. So, sit back, relax, and enjoy the podcast. The geek news last fortnight really was a bit drab and dreary and not really all that much fun. I do realise this. So this week we're going to start off serious but hopefully finish on a much lighter note. Probably the biggest news for Australian geeks out there is that national security bill that we were talking about last time, the one that essentially will let ASIO, the Australian Secret Intelligence Organisation, pretty much tap anybody on the internet with just one warrant, it's passed. It's gone through. And it has caused a furor. There are many people out there now working very, very hard to put limitations on this. But seriously, it has given ASIO a lot more power when it comes to monitoring the internet and tracking down, well, suspects. Of course, the joy of this and some of the upcoming legislation, including that wonderful metadata retention we talked about a few podcasts ago, essentially means that everyone in Australia is a suspected terrorist. So, I guess that's all right then. And now on to better stuff. Unlike the Australian government, the UK government actually took a proactive step with regards to helping to, legalise something that is considered piracy, even though it isn't. Essentially, they have actually made it completely legal and okay for UK citizens to copy MP3 CDs and DVDs for their personal use. That's something we can do in Australia as long as we don't bypass copy protection, which negates the fact that we can do it in Australia. But the UK law actually goes one further and have included cloud backups when it comes to storing these copies. Now that's a big thing. If you remember a while ago, Optus launched a service where you could legally record TV, which is fine in Australia, but then host it on a cloud service that only you could access, and it ran into all sorts of troubles because it was internet broadcasting and fell over. Anyway, good job, UK. Good to see something progressive and positive and forward-thinking actually happen in this big mess of copyright poo. And talking of progressive, the Australian broadcaster, SBS, has what is a fairly robust on-demand service already. What they have done, though, is they have actually added a library of 400 movies that you can access completely free through their service. Now, SBS does focus a lot on foreign films and more artsy stuff, but really, with this sort of selection in its library, you're probably going to find something you like. For more details, though, just keep listening because it may impact the review that we're doing in just a little while. Of course, with this extra content, it's going to increase the amount of downloads in Australia. And you know what? We're actually hitting a pretty impressive target already. A recent study from the Australian Bureau of Statistics has confirmed in the 3 months leading up to June this year, Australia has managed to hit 100,000 terabytes of downloads. Okay, that is a petabyte. Sorry, an exabyte, I should say. That's a lot of downloads. And I'm sure it's all legitimate. And not at all accessing services from overseas or downloading TV shows so we can watch them without the annoying commercials on Foxtel or commercial TV. Of course it is, honestly. We all know this, right? In a bit of geek movie news, it has been confirmed that there is an epic sci-fi version of a game coming to our big screens. Yep, the guy behind the Mortal Kombat films of the 90s, something else we have mentioned in the past, has announced he is doing an adaptation of Tetris. Apparently they have a story behind it, which will make it a much more imaginative movie. Frankly, I don't see this movie being true to the original game. In other Hollywood-related news, filmmaker and podcaster Kevin Smith, who incidentally in one of his recent podcasts actually said that pretty much if his new film Tusk was not showing in a movie theatre near you, then yeah, it was okay to go to the Pirate Bay to find it. That's progressive thinking. But the main news I want to focus on is Kevin Smith. He is a huge Batman fan, and he is actually going to play a character in the upcoming LEGO Batman 3 game. What character is he going to play? He's going to play Kevin Smith. He's actually not the only one. Apparently quite a few names who are connected to or are just famously big fans of Batman are going to appear in this LEGO game as themselves. Yes, I'm curious. I will check it out. Now, I haven't made any secret of the fact that I'm a bit of a pinball fan, and I'm also a bit of a Big Lebowski fan. How does that go together? Well, the pinball manufacturer Dutch Pinball has shown off prototypes of the upcoming Big Lebowski themed pinball. And seriously, if you are a fan of pinball or Big Lebowski, you have to check this thing out. It looks magnificent, not only with the various Big Lebowski gags and references throughout the artwork on the table, it even has a working bowling alley on a lower table within the machine. It looks magnificent. I just hope one day that I will be able to try this thing out. Or, if you're feeling particularly generous, you could perhaps donate, say, $9,000 to the Rufus Project, and I can order one myself and get it imported to Australia. I'm sure there's somebody out there that wants to do that, isn't there? Hello? Anybody? And finally, in gaming news, just because I love this game, Spelunky is finally hitting the PS4. If you haven't played Spelunky, you should. It may just show up as a combination game you must play / review in the very near future. Unfortunately, it's hit the PS4 a bit too late to really make it to this episode. This fortnight, we're doing something a little bit different with the Geek Review. Not doing a game review, not doing a game you must play. No, this podcast, we're looking at a service available for Australians in relation to streaming media. Now, this one is probably, it's been around for a while, okay? So, it's not really what you'd call a fresh review on a hot new product. But given that they recently increased their streaming library by the fold of 400 movies, I think now's a pretty good time to check out SBS On Demand, don't you? So a little bit about the service itself. Pretty much it's what it says. It's a catch-up service, a la ABC iView, Channel 10, Channel 7, Channel 9, they've all got a catch-up service, but ABC's iView and SBS On Demand are the ones that probably stand out when it comes to content and quality. So how does SBS On Demand differ from these other services? Well, first up, if you're not really fully aware of what SBS offers, it's essentially Australia's foreign language programming channel. That's not to say everything is in a foreign language. It also has a number of shows that don't really get much of an airing, and also managed to score pretty much the exclusive rights to South Park in Australia, pre-Foxtel. So, there's quite a bit on there, and quite a variety in the programs. It's also kind of infamously known for, shall we say, some more erotic films it might show later at night. And you know what? That also ties into SBS On Demand, but I'll get to that subject very, very shortly. Now, one of the advantages of SBS On Demand is that it's available on a wide range of platforms. Of course, you can view it on your PC or Mac through the actual SBS On Demand website, but it also has apps available on Apple devices, on Android, There's PS3, there's Xbox 360. I had a quick look. There is also a PS4 app for this one. Basically, it's identical to the PS3 app, but, you know, that's something. And while it isn't the smoothest of experiences on all these platforms, hey, it's free. So that obviously will impact my review in certain ways. Now, I checked this out on PlayStation 3, briefly on PlayStation 4, on Android, and on PC, just to get a feel, I suppose, of a bit of a wide range of devices. And really, I've got to say, it is a bit clunky across the board, especially on, say, the PS3, where the text is pretty small, even on a big screen TV. So, of course, that makes what's already a bit of a clunky navigation experience extra clunky, because you're kind of squinting to see what's on screen and trying to work out what you're going to watch. Not the easiest experience. Of course, on PC, on tablet, you don't really have this issue, because it definitely is more optimized for these platforms than, say, the PlayStation 3 and the PlayStation 4. Like I said earlier, those platforms are pretty much identical. As with most of the streaming platforms that have apps available on your mobile or tablet device, it could certainly benefit from having that little Chromecast button added in. I'm putting it straight out there. If you're developing an app for a streaming program, put in Chromecast. There is no excuse, and it will increase the use of your app considerably. Talking specifically with the PS3 version, since the PS3 has that very, very handy remote control that can be purchased to assist with your media viewing, SBS On Demand works fairly well with the PlayStation 3 remote. But if you want to, say, pause the video you're watching, or change some settings, or basically do a bit of skipping or whatever, you actually need the controller itself, because it needs one of the thumbsticks to be able to navigate during actual video play. Of course, where SBS On Demand does excel is with that precious content. Now, like I mentioned earlier, and like I mentioned in the Geek News, SBS has added 400 movies to this service, as well as, like I said, a variety of TV shows that cover most interests. Of course, with this much content, you still got to find what you're looking for. With the movies in particular, not only do you have the genres, they've also made collections depending on what you're looking for. This definitely relates back to, say, some of those more naughty flicks I mentioned earlier. The categories you can go by, the collections, you've got famous faces, so well-known actors. Fright Night is obviously the horror option. Feel Good Flicks for those more uplifting experiences. And Get a Room. So yeah, if you're the sort of person that wants to watch SBS for the more, say, titillating experiences, mind you, some of these movies are also very serious. I don't want to take that impression away. They also have a lot of nudity. So, like I said, SBS makes it easy for you to find what you might be after. On the whole, it would be nice if SBS On Demand was a smoother experience. Like I said, the interface is a little bit clunky. However, what it does offer is a free service with a huge amount of content. And it's going to be especially benefit for anyone who wants to look for something a bit different. Seriously, give this a go. You really have nothing to lose. I probably should also mention the video quality, whilst, as with, again, every single video streaming service in Australia, it doesn't come in HD. It does transmit at a very respectable bandwidth, so the picture quality is still actually quite good, and it plays quite smoothly. So yeah, really, there is no reason not to try SBS On Demand, and there is a good chance you're going to find something you like.
really exciting to be celebrating the 30th anniversary of the 1984 film Gremlins this year. Released in Australia in 1984, Gremlins was the result of a collaboration between Steven Spielberg and Joe Dante. At that point, Joe Dante was known more for his cult movie work. He was from the Roger Corman School of Filmmaking. He, I believe, directed Hollywood Boulevard in 1976, Piranha in 1979, and then The Howling in 1981. So he definitely had a background for doing these creature feature type works. So Gremlins was the perfect project for him. Scriptwriter Chris Columbus, who's probably better known for directing the Home Alone movies, came up with the original story. However, it was not intended to be filmed until Steven Spielberg took an interest in turning Gremlins into a film. Spielberg actually explained, "It's one of the most original things I've come across in many years." It had his blessing, and in turn he became executive producer. Steven Spielberg actually considered a very unknown Tim Burton to direct the movie. However, he hadn't done a full-length film at that time, so Steven Spielberg turned to Joe Dante. Fresh from doing The Twilight Zone in 1983, Joe Dante was brought on as the perfect choice and the selection of Steven Spielberg to be the director of Gremlins. Brat Packers, Judd Nielsen and Emilio Estevez were actually considered for the lead role of Billy, but this went to a virtually unknown Zach Galligan. Phoebe Cates was Billy's love interest, probably better known for playing the lead female in Drop Dead Fred, and she's the infamous bikini girl in Fast Times at Ridgemount High. Both Zach and Phoebe starred alongside many famous character actors of yesteryear who played supporting roles. And of course, what 80s movie is complete without Corey Feldman playing one of the friends? Chris Columbus's script went through many drafts before the shooting script was actually finalised. Now, his version was actually a lot darker. He had things like the beheading of Billy's mum, the gremlins eating a dog, and even one interesting scene where the gremlins attack a McDonald's and eat customers instead of burgers. However, on further inspection, Spielberg and Columbus decided that I think it was better to go for more of a family-orientated film. At this time, it was quite big to have horror and comedy elements in movies. Horror films weren't so much as dark as they had been in the 70s. We were coming through a period where a lot of humorous scenes were counteracted anything terrifying happening in the movies. It almost gave a wave of relief to the audience. So this, alongside movies like Ghostbusters, was a new style of genre and very much something that we're used to in the 80s movie genre. You have to remember that Gremlins was made pre-CGI. Most of the gremlins you see are either animatronics, marionettes, and hand puppets, which makes you realise how much work actually went into this. So much so that Joe Dante said he probably never would direct a sequel because of the amount of work that happened. Too many problems, they kept breaking down, they proved to be very expensive. I heard that the cast even one night fell asleep on set because the gremlins kept breaking down and it just became longer and longer. But I think persistence paid off because, hey, what's a movie called Gremlins without the actual gremlins themselves? Gremlins hit cinemas around the same time as Ghostbusters and still managed to go so well. It was a critical and commercial success, and it even brought a sequel in 1990, much against what Joe Dante had said previously. The movie was made for what was considered quite moderate at $11 million at the time, and it made over $150 million at the box office. It's still a film that we know and love today, and many remember as an 80s classic from their childhood. And Gremlins was also responsible for ushering in possibly a classification that doesn't mean as much to us in Australia, but the PG-13 rating. Alongside Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, it was found that these movies were sort of fitting between being PG and rated R. They didn't want to rate Gremlins R, so it became a new category, PG-13, for darker scenes. We're excited to screen Gremlins for one night only, on Wednesday the 22nd of October at the New Globe Theatre, Fortitude Valley. Come along from 6:30, $10 per person, and experience this 1984 creature feature on the big screen. If you're even more of a Gremlins nut than that, Zach Galligan, who played the role of Billy, is in town next month for the event Supernova. We look forward to seeing you at Gremlins on the 22nd of October.
Can you tell me anything about yourself? Who you are, where you came from? Can you tell me your name?
I can't remember anything.
The Maze Runner, the latest in an ever-increasing stable of movies based on young adult adventure series, has hit our screens. This one, however, does have a bit of a different twist. Instead of the plucky, strong, and independent female main character, This one is all about the boys, and I'm guessing that was probably pretty much a deliberate choice when the makers decided to adapt this to the big screen. The Maze Runner sees our hero Thomas, played by Dylan O'Brien, and to be honest, the way this guy looks throughout the movie, I just kept thinking of him as a young Ray Liotta. Maybe not as good as an actor as Ray, but certainly look-wise, he gave me that vibe. He finds himself waking up on a mysterious elevator, taking him up. He gets to the top and finds himself in a very pleasant glade with a nice wood section and a whole pile of other teenage boys. And surrounding the glade is the maze. What follows is his gradual discovery of what the situation is and what he's up against, and we learn more about the world through his character, basically. About halfway through, the one female character turns up, Teresa, played by Kaya Scodelario, I hope I pronounced that right, and I've got to tell you, she's got very much a Bella look when you look at her appearance, but she's a much better character, so you can relax that. If there's one thing I can say about this movie, it is definitely better than Twilight. Mind you, most movies are better than Twilight. Now, since this is a young adult novel and is based on adventures of young adults left alone, basically, in this mysterious field, the cast is basically very young. And you will see some familiar faces that you will have recognised from other movies in there. Really, you can't say too much about the performances. They're generally, you know, pretty good for what they've got to work with. But the characters themselves are pretty much predictable. You've got the wise Albie, played by Alm Amin, who seems to be the cluest of the lot. You've got the tough, yet determined and very happy with his lot, Gally, played by Will Poulter, who doesn't want the status quo to change. You've got your more athletic ones, and they're the runners, the maze runners, or the title, who explore the maze looking for a way out. You've got the young, chubby little brother figure as well. Really, it is a bunch of stereotypes. Plot-wise, really, there's not a lot to this movie. It sets itself up to be a kind of a combination of Lord of the Flies meets the Hunger Games, but really not a lot happens. And what does happen is ultimately pretty predictable. Okay, that person's going to end up betraying people, that one's going to die in a very touching and emotionally impactful way for the main characters, he's going to sacrifice himself for the others. It is just all there on a big plate in front of you. What the movie does, though, is helps distract you from this very much predictable and ultimately slow-moving plot by having lots and lots of frantic running scenes. Now, of course, there are monsters in the maze that need to be avoided. Of course, nobody has managed to make any progress until our main hero turns up. And you do have many chase scenes, many fast action scenes. What's happening there? It's happening over there. That never settles down. So what that does, of course, is distract you from the fact that the rest of the movie is pretty ordinary. And that's, I guess, where this movie does actually excel. It gives you that sense of excitement, and you do find yourself drawn in. You can't help yourself. Much like Godzilla, which we mentioned last fortnight in our redeeming features section, that has a section which is running through these narrow corridors, constant danger. And yes, you can't help but get excited. Aside from that, there was probably only one other moment that I found even remotely entertaining. And that's when Teresa, who basically turns up in the place unconscious, wakes up and her reaction to discovering where they are. That was probably the highlight of the movie. I won't go any further into that. But that one scene is, yeah, like I said, the finest moment in the movie. So I guess if you took that one scene and all the running, you'd have all the good parts of the movie. Of course, being based on a series of books, it leaves you hanging at the end with a lovely, mysterious cliffhanger as they go off and head off into the sequel, I mean the sunset. Ultimately, The Maze Runner is a bit of a distraction movie. You will enjoy it. I have no doubt about that. Just, if you do insist on going seeing it, don't think too much about the plot itself, because it barely has one, and focus instead on all the runny, jumpy, actiony, dangery bits, and yeah, you will feel excited, and you will feel at least some sense of satisfaction in watching this movie. So yeah, The Maze Runner. It's a bit of all right.
What's through there?
You guys can't just keep me here.
I can't let you leave.
Why won't you tell me what's out there?
That's the maze. Every morning when those doors open, the runners look for a way out. And no one has ever survived a night in the maze.
What happens, Joe?
We call them grievers.
Boy? Oh boy.
Now, after picking a couple of movies that Christian, I guess, hadn't had much experience with for the past couple of redeeming features, you know what? This time around, it's Christian's revenge. Christian picked a movie that I must admit that I have actually been avoiding for a number of years. Well, I guess since this came out in 1980, what, I've been avoiding it for 34 years, I guess? So, Christian, do you want to let everyone know what our redeeming features is about this time around?
Okay, well, thank you, Trevor, and thank you, listeners. The podcast this fortnight is looking at the 1980 Olivia Newton-John vehicle, Xanadu. I never thought I'd be saying that word, actually, on this podcast, and I'm glad I've actually convinced you to watch it.
Well, you're not up for anything.
Oh, well, definitely. After some of the things or tragedies that you've put me through, I thought it seemed only fair to expose you to this, I suppose, disco musical, but even calling it, that's a bit not quite right. But yeah, so I'm interested to see or hear what your take on the film is. And I suppose, going off the top of my head, giving a bit of a background for this, for this movie, if I may launch in,
sure.
You know, Olivia Newton-John, following the wave of Grease in 1978, would have been approached in 1979 about making a movie, which went on to be Xanadu. Now, it was a collaboration with Jeff Lynne, who was the lead singer, I'm not 100% sure of this, of Electric Light Orchestra, or ELO, the band, and they were at the height of their success at that period. And I think riding that sort of post-Grease wave, they were like, right, what's something that we can get on film ASAP to, you know, A, cash in on the current disco and sort of new wave trend and the love of roller skating, and B, to sort of trade in on the success of Olivia Newton-John. And we'd managed to see John Travolta become, you know, quite a hit, you know, with Saturday Night Fever, then Grease, and then he became the it guy. So it became only natural that Olivia Newton-John would be this person. It is a shame, however, that the vehicle that was chosen for her was Xanadu, possibly not the outcome that they were wanting. And it is interesting to see that this collaboration with ELO resulted in what it did. You know, even calling it a musical is probably a bit, I don't know, a bit strange. It's almost a precursor to MTV. What's your thoughts, Trevor, on the film? Where should we start? Did it feel pre-MTV to you?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting thing about it, trying to get the feel of this movie. It kind of tries to come from a few different directions and takes it in quite a few bizarre directions on the way through. I mean, there were some bits there where I was just completely bamboozled by the choices they were making. And I've got to admit, yeah, I found it very, very hard to put my finger on what this movie was going for. I mean, I know what it's about. But yeah, it just really couldn't seem to settle down on one particular thing. Was it a nostalgia vehicle for Gene Kelly? Was it a star-making vehicle for Olivia Newton-John and... oh, what's the guy's name again?
Michael Beck.
Michael Beck. That's him.
Doing The Warriors in 1979, so he was quite popular at the time,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, true. And, you know, is the movie about Michael Beck's character? Is it about Gene Kelly's character? Is it about Olivia Newton-John's character? I mean, who really is the main character? I mean, I think it was focused mainly on Sonny Malone, Michael Beck, but there was just so much about, you know, helping Gene Kelly reach his dream, and what's happening with Olivia Newton-John, and where's she gonna go? It couldn't really seem to pick a direction, I think, through a lot of it.
Definitely. My notes here actually correspond with a lot of what you're saying. It's almost like by including Gene Kelly and all these sort of musical numbers that were homages to these classic, I suppose, golden age of Hollywood. So the film didn't really know whether it was trying to make a classic Hollywood musical, but it was trying to be sort of this new 80s movie, sort of trying to, I've actually got in my notes here, it was bogged down by so many 80s isms, you know, roller skating, bad fashion. There was a lot of numbers where they'd actually have almost fashion parade type wardrobes. But you just have to look, Universal released this, and to be honest, Universal don't do musicals, so it was a weird choice for them to pay homage to the Hollywood musical. But the inclusion of Gene Kelly was an inspired choice, possibly not the best thing to have been last on his resume before passing away. Possibly not the best film to go out with, but hey, it happened. Now, interestingly, Gene Kelly played the role of Danny McGuire, which Trev, this might, if you didn't get the reference. You notice a lot of references to this in the movie. He played the role of Danny McGuire in a movie called Cover Girl in 1945, I believe, with Rita Hayworth. Now, the whole idea is, by him playing Danny McGuire now in Xanadu, he's speaking 50 years later, so he's pretty much playing the same character. And there are, as I watched, you actually hear him make reference to, I had a club in New York City back in 1945, and that happens in this Cover Girl movie. So that's interesting. And also another kind of loose connection there, Xanadu is actually a remake of a Rita Hayworth film from the 40s called Down to Earth. I've never actually seen it. So, you know, all these sort of links, you just see so much. Yeah, were they trying to be as Hollywood as they could? Or did they get Gene Kelly and went, gosh, maybe we go that angle, stuff Olivia Newton-John? I don't know. I think it was just a whole idea of all these mixed ideas, and it just got so bogged down in being just too much of everything.
Well, I tell you what, though, you've just made it slightly more interesting.
It sort of does put a new spin on it. And are you when you say that, you mean the link with Gene Kelly?
Yeah.
Well, it does sort of, it almost then gives the filmmakers a kind of a bit more credit for what they did. You know, it's kind of this little in-joke. You know?
I know. It suddenly is a lot deeper than it appears on the surface. And on the surface, it appears to be a half-full paddling pool.
Oh, that's being nice to it. And, I suppose I'm just backtracking a little. I suppose I should just do a quick recap for the audience that haven't seen Xanadu. It tells the story of Olivia Newton-John, who plays the role of Kira, who's one of Zeus's muses or goddesses or whatever you call them. Mm-hmm. And she's sent down, actually, she emerges from a painting in which she is painted on, and becomes Michael Beck's muse. And pretty much it's summed up with, she's sent to Earth to help inspire him to open Xanadu, this ultimate, I suppose, you'd love to say rock palace, but disco roller skating rink, possibly.
And disco roller skating rock swing thing.
And that's, yeah, and that's then touching on what we were saying, the merging of all these different genres in this venue, and so it takes a pairing of Michael Beck, Gene Kelly to open this venue, and Olivia Newton-John's muse to help it become a reality. And that, to be honest, is pretty much all there is to it, you know. And it's linked with a whole heap of very MTV, this is pre-MTV, I might add, very MTV style clips. They could almost be film clips for every ELO song. I don't know, I don't think you'd want to use them as your official video, but just saying.
But you probably mentioning, and I did want to touch on this, and the picture that the muses come out of, what you find is Michael Beck is this struggling artist. He's a serious artist. They really do try to say, I'm a serious artist. I just don't want to copy your record labels into big posters. I'm a serious artist. And I really got sick of that vibe. But he's trying to get himself started, and he doesn't like what he's doing, and he throws his latest picture out the window and litters throughout the streets, and you see it blowing up to this mural where the characters in it start coming to life and dancing, all to this incredibly cheesy backing music. And I tell you what, if there is an anti-littering campaign that I think would work, I think it is in this movie.
That's hilarious. Good point. Good point. Not since Mary Poppins have we seen a scene like that where they throw something out and it just magically, I don't know, turns into something else. It is a crazy scene, and it did just feel like this is a film clip for ELO's latest song starring Olivia Newton-John.
Olivia Newton-John, I thought for a bit her entire contribution to that was just going to be playing Peekaboo.
Oh, I know, quite strange. I know, you just need to do a Google search of Xanadu, and that's quite a common screen cap, her doing that, because it's just so bizarre. It's almost a cult movie icon, that shot. Oh, God, but even that's being nice to it. But it's interesting, because in 1980, you had, well, I suppose movies that were made in 79, you had Can't Stop the Music, which we've spoken about before, the Village People movie. You had Xanadu, and a bit of a rarer film called The Apple, which was set in the futuristic world of 1994, where everyone wore disco outfits. And yeah, so pretty much these three movies were riding the wave of disco. But then even, and I know a lot of times Xanadu does get sort of lumped in with that category, because by this stage disco was dead. They would have made it at the height of when disco was right at its peak, just before it died, and they would have made it and gone, oh gosh, we've put all this effort in, we just still have to release it, and hence the reason that it wasn't as successful as they were thinking. But calling a disco musical probably is the wrong thing, because it's not quite disco. It's kind of verging, I don't know if this is even being nice to it, or I'm not, maybe not using the term correctly, but it felt like it was trying to tap into 80s new wave. Did you get that, Trevor? I don't know if they were using that as a comparison with, you know, how there's a lot of scenes where they compare the classic Hollywood with the now, and I was wondering if that was their representation of now.
Yeah, it did seem to try to bring that in, and I think that's probably with the ELO connection with a lot of the soundtrack and a lot of the music, because ELO, they were quite progressive back in the early 80s, and they were trying new sounds and new music and having the pretentiousness to call themselves an orchestra. But, I mean, they had some good songs.
Oh, like, I'll be honest, I'm actually a pretty big fan, but, you know, of their hits. But, yeah, no, it is interesting, you know, having not knowing their history for you to explain it like that, because, yeah, there are some quite interesting sounds, like there's a song All Over the World in Xanadu, and there's lots of chung, you know, all these sort of futuristic sounds. And I can understand, as you were saying, that was quite cutting edge in 1980.
Yeah, and I'm thinking those transitional effects they use. There's a lot of like those Venetian blind style video transfers.
And it wasn't just once, yeah.
I know, it kept happening. I'm guessing they thought that those were quite advanced at the time, and you look at it now and you just shake your head.
Oh, but and the fact, too, to constantly reiterate that the Olivia Newton-John, or Kira, is a muse, he's always got to be followed by this really strange orange light. They use this a lot in the earlier scenes, you know, her skating, I mean, skating up scenes with a big trail of orange behind her. But there's one particular moment, and I don't know if excruciating is not the word, but there's one scene where Michael Beck, I don't want to ruin too much, but Michael Beck manages to crash through the mural towards the end of the film and try and rescue Kira, who he wants to bring back to help be there for the opening night of Xanadu. And there's a scene, I think it's a song called Suspended in Time, which I believe was also a hit for Olivia, and she just stands there with orange glow and all, I'm surprised she wasn't doing Peekaboo, you know, sings this song pretty much as one solitary take. It was almost like it wasn't MTV, nothing MTV about it. It was so 70s, this sort of shot where, you know, they're just standing there singing to the camera. And that's when it really hit home. Oh, wow, this was made to capitalize on Olivia Newton-John and Grease. That was to me. I don't know. That's what it hit to me. Or the fact, too, that she was a big star. And she was a huge star, even prior to Grease, as a singing star. And I think this was supposed to be a vehicle for her. So, you know, but it did feel strange just doing one continuous shot for 3 minutes as she sang this ballad.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, though. You mentioned the glow. I mean, essentially, it's a neon effect, and they use this neon effect so much. And in that particular solo song with Olivia Newton-John, I couldn't help but laugh by seeing that the neon actually also extended around her shadow.
Oh, no. Oh gosh. You got to love the effects.
Yeah, well, they certainly did.
Yeah, exactly. It yeah, but whether it was the success they anticipated, I don't think so. I did a bit of researching, and apparently the film did scrape through. I thought it would have done worse financially. It was made for $20 million. I might add, I can't see where most of that money went to be honest. And it was made for $20 million and made $22 million. So it wasn't the dud that you were thinking, but we've possibly heard of the Golden Raspberry Awards, which started in the early 80s. Believe it or not, Xanadu was actually the film that motivated the people to create the Golden Raspberry Awards.
Another thing that gives it more depth.
Yes, which kind of makes, and not having done my full research, I wouldn't be surprised if it's sweeped the awards for that year. and not to bag out ONJ or Olivia, you know, it was going to mentioning the fact too that I was going to say how she was given the Golden Raspberry for Worst Actress, which sort of does bring me to her acting in this film, and I don't know, it's something that never quite sits right with you. I don't know.
She was acting?
Yeah. Well, she has, yeah, believe it or not. I saw actually an interview with her recently on TV, and she actually has admitted that she's not a great actress. We kind of gathered. Mm-hmm. And she did say she didn't have the best dialogue or really the best plot or best anything aside from the music to work with in Xanadu. And it almost feels like, to me, I don't know if she's trying too hard, but all of her lines are delivered so breathy. I don't know if she was trying to give off this feel of being a muse or something, but everything's like this. I don't know. It just, there were lines like, I can't believe she was saying things like this. I can't have these feelings. It's beginning to hurt. Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, the cringe-o-meter came out.
Yes, indeed. I mean, and the whole dialogue with her and like when they go through the mural, and I'm assuming it's meant to be Olympus. But again, Olympus is very, very neon-tubey. And you've got like Zeus and Hera having the conversation, and gosh darn, they're so British, and they're all arguing. Oh, I can't remember. Is it a moment or an hour? I don't know. What?
Yes. But then, interestingly, like, I'm not sure of the actress. You know, you've got Zeus and his wife. I'm not sure of her name. But I know Wilfred Hyde White, who did the voice of Zeus, was a big actor in the 50s and 60s. So again, and I think, I think the wife was also, I'm not sure of her name, I'm sure she was from the yesteryear as well. So they were, again, trying to make this connection. So, but why pick British stars of all people? And people that, you know, I suppose this also fits in with Gene Kelly, people that by 1980, the audience is going to this would kind of scratch their head and go, what? So maybe they were trying to get in more of an upper-class, older audience.
Yeah, I think they may have been. I don't think they would have succeeded, but yeah, I can see them going for that. Now that you have told me about the connection with the golden age, I suppose you could say of Gene Kelly's days, I could see them attempting that, and perhaps even, you know, in some of the promotion saying, you know, oh, we've also got these classic people making cameos and appearances.
So it would have been, and I suppose that would have been, they would have been using names like that and Gene Kelly and names like Olivia Newton-John and Michael Beck to get in the younger set. So really, like the movie itself, they were trying on every possible level for it to work. But, you know, as I said before, Olivia Newton-John said the story and dialogue wasn't the best, but, you know, it's something that I'm kind of, but she did say the music's amazing, but I'll touch on that more with the redeeming features, I think, with the music. But, you know, she has pretty much said it was a way to join a whole heap of ELO collaborations together. And I suppose if you're looking at it like that, if you're not looking too much at the plot, I suppose it succeeds. I'm not sure. But it is interesting, actually. There are scenes where Danny McGuire, who's played by Gene Kelly, has a lot of reminiscing about the shock horror, the old days of Hollywood. I mean, the old days, you know, of the 40s. And Olivia Newton-John seems to make quite an appearance in all these sort of memories. It's almost as though she's the same girl. And I don't know if I was thinking too deep or it's just something that I'd never thought about before. But I think the whole point is Olivia Newton-John was Denny McGuire's muse back in the 40s. And she's constantly, I suppose, continued throughout the years. And you know, into 1980, she's decided to come down to Earth and help Michael Beck. But I don't know if that's me looking into it too much.
No, I think it's pretty much what the intent was, the fact that it, again, it's one of those things where they haven't quite, I think, aimed correctly. Right from the outset, it's obvious that Olivia Newton-John is some sort of supernatural being. But then they have these flashbacks back to the 40 where she's there singing with Gene Kelly back in the day. And I think it is that pretty much, even have the whole scene where he meets Kira for the first time, apparently, and he's going, "Do I know you?" And this is after he has the big reminiscing dance scene, which I found interesting that the tap shoes could actually turn themselves off and on throughout this scene.
Oh, that's another cutting-edge technology.
Absolutely. But mind you, it was pretty much Gene Kelly having some sort of hallucination, so I suppose we should cut him some slack.
Oh, exactly. And you know, where possible, we haven't mentioned it to the audience, but those who don't know, Gene Kelly was a famous, very famous actor, but more so dancer in the 40s, sort of up, very much up there with Fred Astaire. I even think he's even better, to be honest. But any opportunity they could to make him dance, whether it be in roller skates or in shoes, it seems to happen in this movie. And, you know, there's that one section where they you know, do the song "All Over the World" by ELO, which just feels like a very bizarre, awkward film clip, when they pretty much are finding a wardrobe for Danny McGuire to wear for the opening of Xanadu. And it's pretty much just him coming out with all these bizarre suits where, again, you're kind of having him wearing this real classic 40s style hat and, you know, suit and everything like that. At first, I think in one of the shots, actually, no, it changes between that and a few strange ones. Mm. But yeah, you've got him doing things like that, and whilst you've got all these supposed new waivers in the background wearing the most bizarre costumes you could ever see in a movie.
Absolutely.
Again, reiterating the disco musical, though, because if you look at Can't Stop the Music and the Apple, there are equally insane scenes like that where it does feel like a music video where they're trying to throw in as much of now as they can, and it's you know, it just feels like overload. But yeah, but yeah. Backtracking, yeah, Gene Kelly very much dances the whole way when he can.
Yeah, funny you should mention Can't Stop the Music, because that particular song, and when it starts and they roller skate through and you got the mannequins that come to life, I was expecting Steve Guttenberg to come roller skating out from somewhere
exactly.
At that point in time. If you haven't seen Can't Stop the Music, the opening of Steve Guttenberging.
You've created a term.
I have. Steve Guttenberg roller skating through New York to this disco tune is something to behold. But if you see that and see Xanadu, you will know exactly what I'm talking about.
let's just say, being a fan of cult movie screenings, if I could get the rights, Xanadu and Can't Stop the Music would be a perfect double feature. That very, you know, in terms of complementing themselves. Whether I'd get a good turnout, I'm not sure. But it'd be interesting. I'm not 100% sure, but knowing the dates when it was actually filmed, because they were both Can't Stop the Music and Xanadu were released by Universal Pictures. So it'd be interesting to see which one it technically was made first, or, you know, or interestingly enough, that might have been filmed on the same, you know, the soundstage next door, you know, based on that scene, it wouldn't surprise me. So yeah, that's quite interesting. But even the opening logo of Universal, just going back to the whole 40s style, it's even a plane going around the Universal globe. So it's trying to do the whole, you know, the old school MGM logo, you know, so it's trying to do the whole old school feeling, and it's just starts like that, but then goes into an 80s song, and yeah, just comes off a bit strange.
Well, I mean, we really haven't done that much redeeming so far, but that opening logo probably is one of the things that I find redeeming. I did actually quite like how it actually started with the old-fashioned logo and the old-fashioned music, but as the plane went around, it became a more advanced plane, then it became a Concorde, then it became a spaceship, as the music itself got more up-to-date. And I did find that a very, very clever use of the Universal logo. I was impressed in that very first moment.
And it went downhill from there?
Big time.
But it's interesting because that might have been their way of almost this whole time travel thing, or you know, showing this, you know, the gap between the 40s and 80s by having it update, as you said. Or it could also have represented Kira travelling through time from when she saw Danny Maguire back in the 40s to Michael Beck in 1980. But I think that's looking into it a bit too much. Let's just say it's an awesome shot, and I do agree with what you mean, how the logo just rushes past, you know, very 80s. But redeeming features-wise for me, and I know we've spoken about him heaps, is Gene Kelly. I'm a big fan, and it's great seeing him in this movie, even though... it was his last movie. He doesn't seem out of shape. You see a lot of actors, you know, from the heyday of Hollywood in their last movie, and they look very frail, and you almost like they're going to cark at any minute. Let's just say that, if I can be so bold. But Gene Kelly looks great in this, and you know, as we've mentioned earlier, it's a great continuation for CoverGirl. Hey, even CoverGirl and Xanadu might work as a double feature. It might fill in a lot of the other blanks, and it might make you think about it even a bit more than just on face value, which the film kind of probably wasn't even going for. But Gene Kelly's definitely a redeeming feature, and it is, in their own unique ways, it is a great cast. You've got Michael Beck, who's fresh from The Warriors, and as a standalone works, and ONJ, Olivia, works pretty much as a standalone, but more so with the singing, and Gene, you know, can hold a movie. But the combination of the three might not have been the best thing, but you know, Gene Kelly is definitely up there with a redeeming feature.
Mm-hmm. He's probably my main redeeming feature. I'm just actually trying to think if I have any other ones.
Yeah, mine are very slight, like the movie.
Yeah. So, you know, he does have personality, and he does have this flair that everything else in this movie is pretty much lacking. So, again, you would like to see a much nicer send-off for this legendary actor, but when it comes down to it, if you've got to accept what he finished up with, at least he finished up giving it his best and not, like, having a phoned-in performance. So, definitely, I do think Gene Kelly added most of the personality to this movie.
Oh, definitely. And I think, you know, if we were to look at it as a vehicle for Gene Kelly, hey, it works. And it could have been, a comeback movie, but not in respect to a lot of the other things that happen in the movie. But for those fans or people that were fans of classic Hollywood, or, you know, had heard about him and were rediscovering him, it worked as a movie. And as you said, he's got great personality, having seen him in all these movies. And, you know, that's the thing. I almost want to make you watch CoverGirl, not for redeeming features, but to show you. Yeah, actually, I almost want to watch it again now, too, to see how much did he try and play the part like Danny Maguire in the 40s. You know, to me, he was Gene Kelly playing Gene Kelly in the 40s. But, yeah, it'd be interesting to watch the movies together and see, really, if he was trying to hone that performance. But, hey, if he was from the golden age of Hollywood, they were true actors. So, hey, he might have been.
Yep.
But something that we haven't touched on much, and... I definitely think it's a redeeming feature. I know you mentioned earlier the word Daggy for possibly one of the songs. I can't remember what it was, but I was thinking, ooh, is Trevor a fan? But I, to be honest, think the soundtrack was one of the best parts about the movie, if not the best part of the film. I actually do have the eightfold LP of Xanadu sitting right behind me.
Doesn't surprise me.
And when I say behind me, I don't mean sitting, jutting out of the waste paper bin. So, I am a fan, but I am, as I said, an ELO fan. And I can't even remember where it stemmed from, but I believe I knew the soundtrack before I'd seen the movie. So, but this has all been sort of in recent years, not something that I grew up with or anything. But no, definitely the soundtrack is great. It's pretty much a lot of Olivia Newton-John ballad, middle of the road sort of stuff. Going, you know, intertwined with ELO doing their experimental thing, and then a couple of collaborations. But I definitely think it's great. It's very solid and very ELO. And there's some songs like All Over the World actually went on to be you know, one of ELO's greatest hits. So, and you know, even Xanadu is dubbed as one of their songs, even though Olivia sings the lead. But so yeah, definitely the soundtrack is the killer for this. And as I said, Olivia Newton-John has said the best thing about it is the soundtrack. And the fact that Jeff Lynne from ELO had approached her about doing this film, you do wonder if it was, hey, I've got a whole heap of new ideas for songs, let's link them together with something. Mm-hmm. So definitely the soundtrack. But what are your thoughts, Trevor, on the soundtrack?
Got to admit, I'm not a big fan of the song Xanadu itself. I mean, it's catchy. You can't deny that. And that's probably the nicest thing I could say about some of the songs is the ones that did become hits. They're catchy. I mean, I'm sure they have their fans. Admittedly, like I said, not the biggest fan of ELO or ONJ. What else I can abbreviate?
We'll come up with something.
And yeah, I really found that a lot of the songs didn't do that much for me. If we want to tie in, I guess, one of the songs, and I'm trying to remember the name of it. I should have written it down, but there's one bit.
I'm actually grabbing the LP as you speak, Trevor, so continue.
Oh, excellent.
I might be able to. Okay, so you can't remember particularly what scene?
Well, yeah, I remember it quite clearly because it was one of the biggest left turns in the movie, and I've got to admit that when it did go very Disney.
Oh, yes.
Don't walk away.
Yes, I'm glad you talked about this because you just reminded me.
Yeah, I can't say I thought too much of the song, but the animation was really, really impressive.
Oh, definitely. It almost felt very pre-Little Mermaid, didn't it?
It did.
But then you wonder, too, is that them also trying to do the, let's try to cater for everyone, let's have animation for the kids as well. But were they also trying to, I don't know, do a homage to, I don't know, classic animation from the movies? I don't know, but it was definitely a very film clip-esque scene. And you weren't expecting it at all. It was almost thrown in at one stage when that had a similar scene earlier, you know, the one where they're just roller skating around in a circle holding hands in the building with all the different effects. It felt like they had that, and then not long after they shoved this song in too. So it did feel a bit like filler, but as you said, it was very you weren't expecting it.
I think it's probably a good sign that basically they threw every idea they had at a wall and went with what stuck.
Oh, you know, and nothing reeks more to me of shit. We've got to get ONJ in a movie and fast to capitalize on this fame that she's getting from Greece. I'm surprised they didn't try and put John Travolta in it too. Imagine him playing the Michael Beck role. Interesting thought.
I may have nightmares.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know what about that or the fact that they'd both be wearing roller skates. Yeah, already getting the image of Gene Kelly wearing roller skates out of my brain.
There's also the disturbingly short shorts that Michael Beck was wearing when he busted into the mural.
Oh, it almost felt like he had just got off the set of the YMCA number from Can't Stop the Music. he might have been one of those guys in the background in that opening shot. But the fashions, you know, I know we've sort of vaguely touched on it, but the clothing, I don't know whether it was them trying to do a representation of what, you know, clothing was like nowadays, whether they were trying to just come up with a totally new look. Maybe they were always trying to, you know, you get a bit of that hint of their touching on spacey sci-fi all the time, you know, just because she comes from up there. It must have this sort of science fiction sort of feel to it. But yeah, a lot of the costuming was quite strange, like the final Xanadu number. You think, wow, this final, you know, she's come, you know, doing this you know, the title song that everyone knows, and then it doesn't end there. She has to do a whole series of sections with as a cowgirl and wearing all these strange rock chick outfits, and it just keeps going on for like another 10 or 15 minutes, and you're kind of going, oh, okay.
yeah, that definitely should have just finished with Xanadu without the embellishments we're talking about.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But there was one bit, I think, where they tried to show her as the true goddess, and she comes up in this golden robe thing, and all I thought was, hey, it's Ming the Merciless's daughter from Flash Gordon.
Oh, exactly. Oh, and it was, as you were saying, it was her trying to show this is my true self, and if anything could be more underwhelming, my gosh.
Could anything be more underwhelming? But yeah, no, it was quite strange. And, you know, not that I want to insert a spoiler alert or anything, but let's just say the final scene of the movie was quite, again, kind of touching on what was Kira, you know. I, you know, how can I say this without giving too much away? But let's just say the final shot involves him and Kira in an embrace or about to go in for a kiss. But Trevor, I'm trying very much to talk about this without giving it away, but I didn't know whether... Is she human now, finally? Has she been given, you know, is she able to come down to Earth now and be with Michael Beck? Or is she just another Kira, another muse from down the track that comes back and comes along to help him? I don't know. That kind of confused me a bit. It's almost like they wanted to leave it with a very loose ending, not to sort of sum it up too well. It didn't have the happy magic ending that I think it should have had. Mm-hmm. I think it should have ended with, yeah, Xanadu opening, and as you said, you know, a shortened version of the title song. Awesome. Credits. Amazing. But no, they have to add all this extra stuff at the end to try and sum it all up.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think, yeah, but Xanadu as well, the club itself, if there's ever an example of, again, what they were going for, I was thinking, is this a nightclub or is this some sort of bizarre roller skating cult?
But a roller skating rink that didn't even have roller skate, a rink as such. Maybe it was roller skate theme night for the opening. I'm not sure. Or were they assuming that because it was 1980, everyone wears that when they go out?
Oh, I'm sure I partied with my roller skates on.
But yes, what a bizarre place. Like, yeah, it was interesting. And the fact, too, I think it was funny that they were Danny McGuire and what's Michael Beck's character?
Sonny Malone.
Sonny, that's it. Very similar to... As they were talking at one stage, and they're like, oh, we're opening tonight. I don't want any photographers and stuff there. No press. This is going to be open to the public. And it's supposed to be opening tonight. Meanwhile, behind him, the place looks half built. So I'm quite surprised at how they managed to have such a big turnaround. Maybe Kira lent a special hand, helping hand for that. I don't know.
She and her Muse sisters came in on a burst of neon and fixed everything up.
Yeah, that must be in the director's cut. I'm sure that scene will make its way to Blu-ray eventually. Ooh, this on Blu-ray. Anyway, I'll leave that for your mind to ponder.
Again, more nightmares.
Exactly. So yeah, so Xanadu. Well, I hope we've convinced people to give it a go. Honestly, look, you know, my personal opinion, I sound like I'm a bit more of a fan than Trevor. You know, it's a guilty pleasure. I don't enjoy it as much as, say, Can't Stop the Music. I don't know if that's saying much, but you know, it's an enjoyable film. Like, you don't watch it and go, like, you might go, it's so bad it's good, or, you know, cringe the whole way through, but you don't, it's not absolutely terrible that you're just, you know, watching it is excruciating. See it to see all these different elements, and hey, we should have sold you on the fact that it's got a lot of these great stars, and look at them individually too. Don't look at the result and how the end elements sort of turned out. You know, appreciate each star for who they are, because and the music, and I think you'll enjoy it a lot more.
Yeah, this is definitely one. If you were or are someone who is a big fan of the song Xanadu, complete with the music video, you're probably going to be in a better mindset to watch this movie. I did learn my lesson from earlier on about trying to force through and how I felt afterwards what I thought was an irredeemable movie as something worth watching. Now, I'm not saying this is anywhere in that same camp, but I mean, to be honest, it didn't do it for me. It has got some good things. Like I said, Gene Kelly certainly gives a good performance. The music, again, if you're a fan of Xanadu and ELO, you're going to tap your toe along. I really don't have anything else. I'm sorry. I found that I did. This one didn't do it for me, I'm afraid. So, but again, I mean, Christian is quite enthusiastic about it, and that's part of why we love doing this. We have very different tastes.
Yeah, but even me saying that too, I go, oh, you saying that, I go, oh, man, am I that much of a fan? But look, it's not. Like, I've seen millions of movies worse than this, hundreds of movies worse than this, and it's if you're looking at it, it's you know, it plods along, it's moderately, it exists, let's just say that, and you know, it's linked together by all these great redeeming features that we've said, but it sounds like Trevor is not as easily convinced, but we made him get through it anyway.
He certainly did. See it as a tribute to Gene Kelly, because he, like I said, in a movie I don't like, I liked Danny McGuire, Gene Kelly.
And yeah, and the fact too that linking so much to classic Hollywood, there's definitely some interest there. So if lovers of Gene Kelly and I suppose classic Hollywood, because I suppose you'd be a fan too, definitely worth checking out. And I think that's definitely the way to look at it as well. Danny McGuire linked with a lot of 80s music or 1979 music. So I'd be interested to hear what people think of Xanadu, whether we've convinced you or turned you against the idea.
Definitely let us know. And if you do watch it, we definitely want to hear your thoughts on the movie and on us for convincing you. I don't know how convincing we were, but you know.
We try.
So definitely let us know. And of course, if you have a movie that you think is irredeemable or you would like us to look at with a bit of a fresh perspective and an open mind, definitely let us know.
Look forward to hearing thoughts.
Absolutely. Well, as always, thank you so much, Christian, and let's see what we can redeem next time, hey?
Yes, thank you, Trevor. Excuse me while I go and put my Xanadu LP on the record player.
Enjoy.
Thank you.
Okay, so this podcast, thankfully, we've got the return of the interview. So it's not just Christian and myself you need to listen to for the entire podcast. And I'm very happy to have on the line with me Louise Marshall, who has a bit of a history in the Brisbane theatre scene, but has most recently come to our attention, in being involved with Music in the Moonlight, which looks like to be quite the event. So, Louise, how are you?
I'm good, thank you, Trevor. Very good.
Fantastic. So, I suppose just so our listeners can find out a bit of who you are, perhaps you could just give us a quick a rundown, I suppose, of the sort of things that you have done, both from, say, a performance side and even organising stuff.
Okay. Well, about 10 years ago, I was working as a solicitor, and I decided to get back involved in the arts as an actor. And I was involved in a few productions at the Brisbane Arts Theatre. So I did some roles in The Ladies Not for Burning, The Taming of the Shrew, the Terry Pratchett plays, which I think they're still running at the Arts Theatre. And then from my involvement with that, I got involved with directing kid shows. And then I decided one day that I was a little bit tired of playing the damsel in distress. And I thought, what I need to do is write something that I would like to play. And what I would like to play is a homicidal maniac who kills everybody and does it to a bitchin' soundtrack. So that's what I did. So I wrote a show called One by One. Then I realised, of course, you can write a show, but to actually get it on, you need someone to put up the money and produce it. And I realised that I would have to do that. So I decided to produce it, and I put it on at, as I said, at the Metro Arts. And we broke even. We didn't lose money, which was a little bit of a miracle in theatre land. And we also got some really good reviews. In fact, Scene Magazine said it was one of their picks for the best plays for that year. So sort of spurred on by that, I quit being a lawyer. I certainly didn't quit for the money, but I quit to give myself an opportunity to be able to write and also to study. I joined the Actors Workshop to get some training in film and television. And then I kept writing. I wrote some a cabaret show called Rough, which again was well received. And so I turned it into a stage show, Corporate Works a Bitch, which was based on all my experiences as a lawyer. And that sold out before we opened. So we knew we were on, onto a winner with that. So at the same time, I started directing kid shows, and I wrote another cabaret show, Eastern and Western. But then I started to get involved in actually television, because I had done some commercials for some of the local production companies, and I'd done some work with them. And I was asked to pitch corporate as a TV show. And so I worked with some people like Bradley Howard from Monkey TV, who's done a lot of stuff with Sean McAuliffe. And eventually on my journey, I got involved with Tropfest, and they had a development program which they would pitch shows to Foxtel. And so my show got selected, and we almost got up. It came down to my show and the show The Jesters. And as probably everybody knows, The Jesters has been on Foxtel and my show hasn't. But it was, you know, trying to write for TV is a very long journey. There's not a lot of money out there. But it's been I don't regret the journey, so to speak. It's been very interesting. I've met some really good people along the way. I now, as a little source of income for myself, do some writing for production companies. And, you know, it's been a while, but I occasionally, you know, get a commercial, or I might do some corporate videos. And on the other side of things, I teach and do workshops for kids with drama. And my final show that I've done, I won't say final, I should say my last show that I've done, was actually a kid show, which I did in 2011 for Christmas. And we got 1,400 people through the door. It was a fantastic experience. And again, I wrote it. I feel like I'm a little bit like the guy off Little Britain. I write the theme tune, sing the theme tune. Well, I write the show and I produce it. And because I get to do that, I also managed to get myself a decent part, which is good fun. So the future for Lulabelle Productions, which I was actually having a conversation with my business partner about, we would like to do another kid show. And with the advent of the internet and the lovely thing called the web series, I'm in talks with some people about making corporate into a web series. And I've got some support from some local actors, and also from some local producers and directors. So hopefully next year will be a really good year, and we'll get some more work out.
Wow, fantastic. I suppose in the interest of honest broadcasting, I actually was lucky enough to perform with Louise in one of those Terry Pratchett plays at the Brisbane Arts Theatre way too many years ago to think about. So it was quite a surprise to find that out. Now, probably looking at what's coming up, now, as we mentioned, you're heavily involved with helping to organise music in the Moonlight. So how about you tell us a little bit about what Music in the Moonlight is, and how you got involved with that?
Okay, well, Music in the Moonlight is a festival that a local primary school, Martyr Day at Ashgrove West, put on. Many, many years ago, the parents decided that the school was possibly too small to support the local fundraiser, which is, you know, the obligatory fate. And they got their heads together and they thought, well, what do we want to do to raise money for the school? And the answer was, well, let's go somewhere, drink lots of alcohol and listen to some really good music. And preferably, can we do it in costume? And that is pretty much how Music in the Moonlight was born. And it proved to be a huge success and became, I guess, a little bit of an institution, I guess you could say, for the Ashgrove area. So 24 years ago, they did the first Music in the Moonlight, and it was done at Dorrington Park. And I can remember going, oh, it would have been a good 10 years ago to an event, even though I didn't have children and wasn't connected with the school. And I had the most amazing night. They had fantastic music. Everybody was dressed in a different costume. I had to go. My sister-in-law was dressed as Wilma from Fred and Wilma from the Flintstones, and my brother couldn't make it. So I actually went as transsexual Fred. And I just had a ball. Everybody, as I said, gets really into the swing of it. They design and construct sets. and they just let their hair down. It's just a, you know, a huge bunch of people letting their hair down. 8 years ago, we took it back into the school for various reasons. And so from 2009 until this year, it's actually been done at the school. And unfortunately, even though it's still been a really great event, once we took it back into the school grounds, it wasn't as attractive for, you know, the general public to come along. So we decided this year with our 25th anniversary around the corner that we would try and go back to Dorrington Park. So we're going back. We're going back to the park, to Dorrington Park. And what we're hoping to do is see a lot of local people coming and just having a really good night out that is designed for adults to let their hair down and listen to some fantastic music. So that's what we're doing. And it is, as I said, a fundraiser for Mardi Day, but it really is more like a festival. This year we've picked a theme and it's Cult Movie Madness. I should say Cult Movie Mayhem, and we're going to have an 11-piece band, the Soul Men, who are a Blues Brothers tribute band, and they also come along with the Bluesmobile, which should be good. They have obviously Jake and Elwood, but they also bring a female singer, fully resplendent in a nun's outfit, you know, belting out Aretha Franklin and Tina Turner hits and all those kind of songs. We're also going to have a cabaret show, Attack of the Killer soundtrack, utilising the talents of Kristen Fletcher's crew, as well as Danny Lazar, Al-Maurice Burton. There's about 13 performers in the cabaret show, and they're working very hard at the moment. And then we'll have, you know, awesome ultimate experience auctions where you can auction, you know, bid on a Top Gun auction, where you get to be a pilot at the Boeing flight simulator. We'll have incredible raffles. We've got Donna Gibb, local artist, painting a beautiful piece of artwork on the night, which is going to be put up for auction. We're going to have heaps of food that you can eat, from Grub Cartel, Paco's Paella, Wood Fire Pizzas, Rosalie Gelateria are going to be there. And we're also theming the entire area. So instead of having the audience, so to speak, coming and doing their sets like we used to do in the past, the committee has worked really hard and we've actually created all different movie sets. So we're going to have the Electric Psychedelic Pussycat Swingers Club Lounge. We've got Cocktails and Dreams. We don't have Tom Cruise, but we do have a glow bar, and I think people would prefer the glow bar with I forget what the proper term for a cocktail guy is, a mixologist behind it, doing fresh cocktails, cosmopolitans, mojitos, peach bellinis. Of course, with the Blues Brothers band, we had to have Bob's Country Bunker, where they've got two types of music, country and western, and they'll be serving, you know, apple cider, premium beers, wine. We're going to replicate Jack Rabbit Slim's, the 1950s diner from Pulp Fiction, and we're also going to have two vintage cars flanking on the premises. We'll have the Moulin Rouge click booth where you can get your photos taken. And we're going to have special guest appearances by, you know, I've got to say this was one of the most exciting parts of it for me. We're going to have the Star Wars garrisons. So we're going to have the Rebel Alliance, and we're going to have the 501st Redback Garrison. And they might even be called upon to do a bit of a lightsaber display on the night. So there's going to be heaps to do for everyone. We'll have cabaret seating. Everything is stylized. Even the bank will have FPOS facilities, but it won't just be FPOS. It will be Gordon Gekko's bank. You know, we've gone all out. We want everyone to have a kick butt time. You can come dressed in costume if you want to. If you don't, that's okay. You don't have to come in costume. But I've got to tell you, I could play the game. It's a bit like 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon. It wouldn't matter what you wear. I reckon I can pick a movie. If you want to come in your sleeping robe, like your nightie and a gown, I can tell you that's Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
perfect.
Yeah. So it's a night to let your hair down and have a good time and listen to some really good music. And don't bring children. There's no children allowed. What more could you want?
Sounds amazing. Absolutely amazing. I mean, seriously, obviously, as anyone listening to the podcast can tell, this certainly can now know why we wanted to speak to you with this incredible event being planned. So I suppose probably the most important thing, if anyone out there who wants to go and hasn't got their tickets yet, where can they go?
You can go on the internet to www.musicinthemoonlight.com.au. You can go onto Facebook, and if you punch in Music in the Moonlight, we will definitely pop up and you can find out the details there. You're certainly welcome to ring the school Mater Dei, but your best bet is to basically go online, as I said, to musicinthemoonlight.com.au. Tickets are $50. That gets you your entry. And I can tell you that we are hoping at the entry to have flaming torches. So I'd go just for the flaming torches personally myself. That would do it for me. That gets you 5 hours of entertainment. With our food providers and also with our alcohol, we've tried to make it as cheap as possible. So I can tell you that premium beers and apple cider are only $6 on the night. Or if you want to get in early, you can get a wristband and three drinks. Instead of paying $6 a drink, it's $5 a drink, three for $15. Cocktails, you can get three cocktails for $20, or on the night, they'll be $8 each. The food will range in price from around $3 to $20. So we're trying to make it as reasonable as possible for everyone to come and have a really good night.
So just to confirm, better give us the where and the when.
Okay, so it's at Dorrington Park at the Hockey Club, Ashgrove. It is an outdoor event. It's on Saturday the 25th of October. It starts at 6 p.m. and it's all over Red Rover by 11 p.m.
Fantastic. And if you didn't catch any of the details, I'll be making sure that all the links and everything are down below in the description of this podcast. So make sure you head down there and start clicking some of those links. Is there anything else that you would like to plug or bring up?
Look, the only thing I will say is I've been so impressed by the Soul Men. They've been doing some seriously good gigs lately. They've just been at QPAC. They did the Mitchell Blues Festival, and they are very, very dedicated to the band and to their craft. And I've listened to them on the clips, and just from speaking to them, they are determined to give everyone a really good night. And I know with the cabaret show as well, you know, there's going to be some absolute classics. You know, who can go past Xanadu, a bit of Fame, the things that you're gonna laugh, but you're also gonna wanna dance to. So I really do think there is something for everyone to come and enjoy. And the Blues Brothers music, they don't just do songs from the Blues Brothers movie. As I said, they also do Tina Turner songs. They do The Commitments. Pretty much anyone who fits in with that genre. So I think there'll be something for everyone to enjoy on the night. And I think that's pretty much sums it up. It is just it's going to be a great night. It's going to be a party in the park. And as I said, it's for adults, no kids. What more could you want?
Well, Louise, that sounds absolutely fantastic. Certainly it's something that I would love to get along to. And if I can't get along to it, I definitely want to check out the Soul Men now. I've heard about them for a while and never gotten a chance to see them. So got to see them. I love the Blues Brothers. Well, thank you very much for talking to us. And thank you for being on the Rufus Project.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. It's been good reconnecting with Igor. It was Igor, wasn't it?
Yes, it may well have been Igor. Yes, Rasha.
That's how Nanny Og used to talk.
Oh, yes. Oh,
God, that was a long time ago.
It was. Oh, yeah, again, Thank you so much.
Okay, no worries, Trevor. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
It's time to look at some of my upcoming events taking place around Brisbane. On Saturday the 18th of October, the infamous Tracks Party is back at the Port Office Hotel. Hearing the best of the 80s, and possibly some hits you might not have heard for a while, come along from 7pm until late, when DJs Missy Boots and Lisa Electro will give you a retro night to remember. Get your friends together, dress up in your best 80s wear, and hey, it's even free entry. See you from 7 o'clock on the 18th of October. You heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen, my Halloween program, which is taking place at events all around Brisbane from the 22nd of October. Kicking off at the New Globe Theatre, we're really excited to have got special permission from Warner Brothers to screen Gremlins for its 30th anniversary and Lost Boys from 1987. These screenings are taking place on Wednesday the 22nd of October for Gremlins and Thursday the 23rd of October for Lost Boys. Tickets are available at the door for $10 per person, and I definitely recommend getting along and seeing these classics on the big screen. The program doesn't end there. The following week at Room 60 at Kelvin Grove's Urban Village, we're doing a 1950s B-grade double feature. We're turning the intimate bar into a 1950s drive-in, complete with trailers, drinks, and many more. On the bill, we're excited to have 1958's Attack of the 50-Foot Woman, followed by The House on Haunted Hill, starring Vincent Price from 1959. The double feature kicks off at 6:30pm, and even better, tickets all night are only $5 per person. To celebrate the 30th anniversary of Ghostbusters this year, we're excited to have a Halloween party on Friday the 31st of October, which is Ghostbusters theme. We'll have the Queensland Ghostbuster franchise, who will be there looking for mysterious and supernatural occurrences within the venue, and will also be there complete with Mr. Stay Puft. This is free entry and kicks off as early as 6 o'clock. The boys will be there from 7 till 9pm for photos and for general shenanigans. Playing the best of 80s, 90s and party hits, get along to the Port Office Hotel upstairs on Friday the 31st of October for a Halloween party you won't forget. For full details about my upcoming events, visit www.christianfletcher.com, and I look forward to seeing you again soon.
This podcast, we have got some competitions really worth entering. Seriously, this time it's all about the quality movies. Please, trust me. Have I led you astray before? Don't answer that. First up, we've got yet another 30th anniversary screening to help all us people who remember the original movie feel extra, extra old and hopefully introduce some new people to a quality film. Yes, the first ticket we have is a double pass to see Gremlins at the New Globe Theatre on the 22nd of October. Again, this is a special 30th anniversary screening and certainly worthwhile. How to win this ticket? Well, simply leave the word Mugwai in any of the usual places. But wait, we do have another one. If you can't make a movie on the 22nd of October, how about the 23rd? With a special screening of the classic Corey Feldman, Kiefer Sutherland, Corey Haim movie, The Lost Boys. Oh, I love this one, and incidentally, I may just be at this particular screening. To win this great ticket, simply leave the comment Frog in the various places. Now, I will go through all the contact details at the end of the podcast, but just remember, Gremlins, leave the comment Mogwai, or for the Lost Boys, leave the comment Frog. Good luck, and hope to see you guys at the Lost Boys. Thank you so much for listening to The Rufus Project. We hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as we enjoyed putting it together, and we want to hear from you. So if you have any feedback, requests, suggestions, you have a redeeming features movie that you want to challenge us with, or you just want to enter one of our great competitions for those double movie passes, simply find The Rufus Project on YouTube, on Twitter, on Facebook, of course. We're also on Ustream, and you can simply leave the comments that you wish. You can also head to our homepage, therufusproject.podomatic.com, and leave comments there as well. If you're feeling particularly happy about what you've just listened to, why not review us on iTunes? It will all help, and definitely, the more exposure we can get for this podcast, the wider we can spread our wings, and the more cool stuff we can bring you. We also always want to hear from anybody who has an event or feels that they have something that could be included in our local wildlife section, much as Louise was in this very podcast. You can contact us at any of the aforementioned places, or even just send us an email, old-fashioned I know, to rufusreviews@gmail.com. And finally, you know, I can never think of a decent sign-up for these things, so again, I'm after your suggestions. If you have something you want me to say at the end of this podcast, I'll try to keep it family-friendly. It can be a bit naughty, though, I don't mind that. Get your suggestions in. I'm happy to read out just about anything. In the meantime, though, until next time, I couldn't think of a witty sign-out and wasn't given one, so feel free to add your own. See you next time. Going the epic sci-fi angle, I can actually see the Tetris movie being more a tense, suspenseful thriller. You know, the sweat on the brow, the furrowed conversation of a man at the edge of his limits as he waits for that one elusive straight piece to come down and clear his way. And he then loses his mind when he gets one of those damn wiggly bits that simply stuff up everything he has planned. Yeah, that'd work.